5. To the choir master, according to lilies, a maskil of the sons of Korah, a love song. My heart overflows with a pleasing theme. I address my verses to the king. My tongue is like the pen of a ready scribe. You are the most handsome of the sons of men. Grace is poured upon your lips. Therefore, God has blessed you forever. Gird your sword on your thigh, O mighty one, in your splendor and majesty. In your majesty, ride out victoriously for the cause of truth and meekness and righteousness. Let your right hand teach you awesome deeds. Your arrows are sharp in the heart of the king's enemies. The peoples fall under you. Your throne, O God, is forever and ever. The scepter of your righteousness is a scepter of uprightness. You have loved righteousness and hated wickedness. Therefore, God, your God, has anointed you with the oil of gladness beyond your companions. Your robes are all fragrant with myrrh and alloys and cassia. From ivory palaces, stringed instruments make you glad. Daughters of kings are among your ladies of honor. At your right hand stands the queen in gold of Ophir. Hear, O daughter, and consider, and incline your ear. Forget your people and your father's house, and the king will desire your beauty. Since he is your lord, bow to him. The people of Tyre will seek your favor with gifts, the richest of the people. All glorious is the princess in her chamber, with robes interwoven with gold. In many colored robes she is led to the king, with her virgin companions following behind her. With joy and gladness they are led along as they enter the palace of the king. In place of your fathers shall be your sons. You will make them princes in all the earth. I will cause your name to be remembered in all generations. Therefore, nations will praise you forever and ever. Well, boys and girls, did you spot the difference with this royal wedding? Who's the center of attention? It's the bridegroom, isn't it? The man, the king. It's not the bride. We see that by how it's introduced in verse 1. It's a love song for a royal wedding. It's addressed to the king, to the bridegroom. This is what makes it a unique psalm in the Psalter. Psalms are usually addressed to God or they're about God. This is the only psalm in the whole Psalter which is not about God. It's about the king, this bridegroom. And he remains the center of attention throughout. Just glance down at the verses from verse 2 to 9, they're about him. And verse 16 to 17, they're about him. The bride only gets three verses, 13, 14, and 15. This song is about a bridegroom on his wedding day, not really about the bride on her wedding day. The songwriter may be the king's best man, which I think makes good sense. It's certainly someone who knows the king and admires him. And his admiration for the king overflows into song. Older versions have that lovely phrase, "My heart bubbleth over," into song. And here's the best man who can't keep his wedding speech to himself. He has to sing it to everyone. And it's sung before it's written, verse 1. It's in his heart first, then on his tongue, before it flows out of his pen. That's the best kind of love song, isn't it? One that comes out of the heart. It's spontaneous. But what is it about this king that causes this songwriter to burst into spontaneous praise? Well, it's there in verse 2. You are the most handsome of the sons of men. There's the big surprise, boys and girls. The bridegroom out-beautifies the bride. He's the center of attention. He's the beautiful one. And we see this in five ways. First, there's the beauty of His words, verse 2. The beauty of His words. You are the most handsome of the sons of men. Grace is poured upon your lips. There's another surprise. The defining beauty of this king is not his looks, but his lips. It's not his height. It's not his hair. It's not his eyes. It's not his physique. It's his speech. It's not what he looks like that makes him beautiful. It's what he sounds like. His words drip with grace. His words are forgiving. They're freeing. They're favoring. They cleanse the dirty. They release the captive. They show favor to the guilty. This is what would have been in the Israeli daily the day after the wedding. The king's speech. Sounds like a movie about King George the VII. Remember? He was remembered for his speech. He had a speech impediment, but he spoke a speech just before World War II that he is remembered for. And that's the identifying mark of this royal bridegroom. His speech. His gracious words. And for his gracious words, look at what he receives. Verse 2. Therefore, God has blessed you forever. He receives an eternal blessing. In Bible times, the concept of blessing was a very material, very physical reality. And in this case, it meant that the king would have sons forever. So for being a man of grace, he gets to be a man of posterity. He's blessed with an eternal dynasty. Sons will sit on his throne forever. So that's the first mark of beauty of this king, the beauty of his words. And second, there's the beauty of his war. The beauty of his war, verse 3 to 5. Gird your sword on your thigh, O mighty one, in your splendor and majesty. In your majesty, ride out victoriously for the cause of truth and meekness and righteousness. Let your right hand teach you awesome deeds. Your arrows are sharp in the heart of the king's enemies. The peoples fall before you. If verse 3 was about him being a forgiving king, here we see he's a fighting king. His lips drip with grace, but he has a sword strapped to his thigh. And he has a quiver of arrows on his back. It's not a toy sword. They're not plastic arrows. They pierce the heart of his enemies. People fall before him on the battlefield. He's a warrior who slays his enemies. That's what makes him beautiful. It's what makes his war beautiful. Now that might sound like a bit of a contradiction. How can a warrior and his war ever be called beautiful? Well, let me take you to Buchenwald, to one of the Nazi concentration camps in Germany. Jackie and I visited it a number of years ago when we traveled through Germany. And throughout the whole visit at that camp, we felt physically sick as we saw the inhumane conditions that the Jewish prisoners lived under. We saw the bear cage outside the camp, beside the wire fence where the Nazis would feed the bear meat to taunt the Jews that the bears ate better than them. We saw the gas chambers. We saw an execution chamber with a hole in the wall where Jews would be asked to stand on the other side and Nazi soldiers would play games of seeing who could shoot through the hole in the wall. We both felt physically sick throughout the whole tour of this concentration camp. But there was one symbol of hope, and it was the clock at the entrance of this camp. It read 3:15 p.m. It had never read anything else since the end of World War II, because that was the time when the American soldiers discovered Buchenwald and released the prisoners from their captivity. Now, when the Jewish prisoners saw American soldiers outside the fence in their tanks and their military vehicles, they saw fighting men. To their eyes, were they horrible or beautiful? They were beautiful, weren't they? because of what they had come to fight for. Ask any Jewish prisoner, was the Second World War beautiful or horrible? It was beautiful because it led to their freedom from the tyranny of evil men. Fighting men are beautiful men when they have a just and good cause to fight for. And that's like this king. The songwriter celebrates the beauty of his war because of what he fights for. Do you see that in verse 4? He rides out for the cause of truth, humility, and righteousness. That's what makes his war beautiful. He replaces lies with truth, pride with humility, wickedness with righteousness. But the question is, why is this songwriter even speaking about war here? Isn't this a love song for a royal wedding, not a military song for battle? So why combine wedding and war? Well, in the case of kings, wedding and war always go together. Just think about what Prince Charles and Prince William got married in on their wedding days, if you remember. Their military uniforms. Why their military uniforms? Could they not have found a nice suit of tails or a nice tuxedo? It's because for kings, weddings and war go together. The defense of the realm is linked to the continuation of the royal line. Kings are called to defend their kingdom. And one of the ways is to have a kindred. If you have no kindred, then when you die, the enemy will come and take over your kingdom. Wedding and war go together when you're a king. And that's why the songwriter includes this aspect of the king's beauty. Because the establishment of this king's kingdom is dependent on him having a bride. The establishment of his kingdom is dependent on him having a bride. It's why they're such interested in Prince William and Prince George. Because they symbolize the future of the British Empire. They ensure the Queen's dynasty. They ensure that the empire will stand for goodness and truth and justice like she has. And if we're going to grasp the beauty of this king, we have to see him not just as a forgiving king, but as a fighting king about to get married. That's what makes him beautiful, the beauty of his war. So there's the beauty of his words, the beauty of his war, and third, there's the beauty of his rule, verses 6 to 7. The beauty of his rule. This king's throne is an eternal throne that lasts forever, verse 6. Your throne, O God, is forever and ever. Now, addressing the king here as God was not entirely out of place in the Old Testament, since the king was God's son. He was to have a God-like, a divine-like status. His rule over Israel was to feel like God's rule. And that's the kind of kingdom that he was establishing, a kingdom of uprightness. His rule is founded on the right, maintains the right, promotes the right. He's no usurper. He's no oppressor. He's a good king, an upright king. And that's the kind of kingdom he founds. And this is because of the kind of person he is. Verse 7, you have loved righteousness and hated wickedness. There's no neutrality in this king. He understands the great antithesis in the world between righteousness and wickedness. And he loves the one and he hates the other. And this is what serves as the foundation for the kingdom of uprightness, the king's moral compass. His moral affection for what is good, his moral disaffection for what is evil. In other words, the beauty of this king is not so much outward, but inward. We look on the outward appearance of the bridegroom. This songwriter is looking on his heart. And just as there was a reward for the beauty of his words, verse 2, he was eternally blessed. So there's a reward for the beauty of his war and the beauty of his rule. Verse 7. Therefore, God your God has anointed you with the oil of gladness beyond your companions. He is joyfully anointed. Anointing speaks of a ceremonial occasion. Perhaps this was his coronation following his victories in battle. And the sounding note of his coronation is gladness. For his love of righteousness and hate of wickedness, for his war on lies and pride and wickedness, in the name of truth, humility, and righteousness, this king is rewarded with being the happiest man on earth. It's quite a nice reward if you've been at war. You're rewarded with gladness. There's the oil. There's the smell of nice fragrances on his clothes. There's the music echoing through his ivory palaces, verse 8. There are the guests in attention, verse 9, the daughters of other kings who come to honor his beauty. And then there's the queen in the gold of Ophir. Now the queen here might be his bride, or it might be his mother, the queen mother, who herself is decked out in the finest gold available. If the queen is the bride, then the songwriter sort of fast forwards the proceedings and gives us a snapshot of the king in his palace with his bride on his right arm, like when Prince Charles and Princess Diana appeared on the balcony after their wedding, or Prince William and Kate. It's like a future snapshot. But I don't actually think that's the case. I think this is the queen mother, because it breaks the flow of how the psalm unfolds to jump forward to the queen standing at his side. The bride doesn't enter till verse 13, and she's called a princess. So I think it's better to see here the queen mother standing beside her son, waiting for her son to be married. But in either case, whether it's the bride or the queen mother, we get the point of gladness. There's the oil, the clothes, the smell, the ivory palace, the music, the beautiful ladies in waiting. A queen dressed in the finest gold available. It's the picture, a perfect picture of joy and gladness. Isn't it? Or is it? Boys and girls, perhaps you can help me out here. Why is this beautiful king, this picture of this beautiful king with his beautiful smelling clothes, his ivory palace with music playing, the beautiful ladies surrounding him, why is this not yet the perfect picture of joy and gladness? Who's missing? It's the bride, isn't it? You can't have a love song about the most beautiful man in the world, the most handsome of the sons of men, and he's on his own. Have you ever heard of a love song like that? As Jane Austen put it, it is a truth universally acknowledged that a single man in possession of a good fortune is in want of a wife. Here's a man, the most beautiful of men, in possession of a good fortune. He has the gold of Ophir to dress his mother in, and he's in want of a wife. And so we're waiting for the bride to walk in. But there's the surprise. She's not coming. You're expecting verse 13 to come. All glorious is the princess in her chamber with robes interwoven with gold. In many colored robes she is led to the king. But verse 13 doesn't follow verse 9. It seems in verse 10, 11 and 12, that she's not coming. She's hesitating. She's having second thoughts. Look at the four rapid fire commands. Hear, O daughter, the bride. Hear, O daughter, consider. Incline your ear. Forget your people and your father's house. It's an exhortation to the bride not to have second thoughts, not to be distracted, not to look back, not to delay, but to come to the wedding, to be his bride. That's the tense part of a wedding, isn't it? The beginning. Will the bride turn up? It's now the tradition, isn't it, for the bride to be a little bit late. It adds to the tension. Will she follow through with her commitment to the man who proposed to her, who put an engagement ring on her finger? Or will she back out? That's a bit like what's going on here. It's as if this bride is feeling the weight of what she's about to do. perhaps feeling slightly unsure, perhaps having some sideways glances at some other men. Because marriage is a big commitment. It's a lifetime commitment to one person, and it's a big deal. The Anglican Book of Common Prayer says marriage is not to be entered inadvisedly, lightly, or wantonly. Why? Because marriage is a big deal. I think most couples have moments when the weight of what they're about to do in their courtship or their engagement hits them. A lot of couples I know who are happily married had wobbles in their engagement or their courtship. Jackie and I were no different. We had a wee wobble. I still try to tell myself that Jackie had the wobble because she was feeling weak at the knees, because she couldn't believe her luck. But Jackie's side of the story is that marrying me was a big deal. Why? Because marrying me meant leaving her family and her country. If you've married internationally or cross-culturally, then you know exactly how we both felt. Marriage was a big deal. And it was the same for this bride. She's clearly from another country, from another people. She lives in her father's house with her family. Leaving her home and her country and her father and family was a big deal. And that's why there's this interlude in the song. That's why the songwriter sort of stops the flow and pauses to exhort the bride to come to the wedding. And he does so by giving her some motivations. If she leaves her people and family to cleave to the king, he'll desire her beauty. She'll become the center of his attention. If she leaves her people and family, she will come under his authority as her lord. Nothing bad if he's a man of truth, humility, and righteousness. If she leaves her people and family, she'll become a woman of influence. Verse 15. Tyre was the most prosperous neighbor to Israel, the richest of the peoples. And yet the people of Tyre will come to her for favor. It's a bit like Kate, the Duchess of Cambridge. Remember her and William had their wee wobble? They broke up for a time. Well, let's imagine they'd never gotten back together. Do you think Kate would have been asked to open hospitals, attend charity balls, if she just remained Kate Middleton or married someone else? No, it's her marriage to Prince William that has made her a woman of influence for good causes. Perhaps that was one of her motivating factors. It's a good motivation, along with William desiring her beauty. Well, we all know what happened with that royal wedding. William and Kate got over their wobble. She came to the church. And so does this bride, verse 13. All glorious is the princess in her chamber with robes interwoven with gold. In many colored robes she is led to the king, with her virgin companions following behind her with joy and gladness. They are led along as they enter the palace of the king. This brings us to the fourth aspect of the king's beauty, the beauty of his bride. We've seen the beauty of his words, the beauty of his war, the beauty of his rule, and now here's the beauty of his bride. But notice there's another surprise. We're not told about her looks or her hair or her flowers. We are told about her dress, but notice what it's interwoven with, gold. A bride in those days couldn't afford gold. Gold was the most expensive material. The gold of Ophir in verse 9 is the finest gold in the world. Only kings could afford this kind of gold, which means that her robes have been given to her by the groom. She couldn't have afforded this dress. Her beauty is given to her by the beautiful king. She looks beautiful, but only because of his beauty. And this focus on the bridegroom and his beauty returns in the closing verses, where we see the final aspect of his beauty, the beauty of his children. The beauty of his children, verse 16 and 17. In the place of your fathers shall be your sons. You will make them princes in all the earth. I will cause your name to be remembered in all generations. Therefore, nations will praise you, forever and ever. Those final verses are a bit like the best man's toast at a wedding reception. Only this is not his best wishes for the groom, but rather a prophetic prediction about the groom. The "you're" in verse 16 and 17 is singular. He's not saying to the couple, "your name together will be remembered." He's saying to the groom, "your name will be remembered." And notice that even when he does have sons, it's not his sons' names who will be remembered, but still his name. Boys and girls, at present, when we sing the national anthem, we sing, "God save our gracious Queen." But one day she'll die, and Prince Charles or Prince William will sit on the throne, and then the song will change. We won't sing, "God save our gracious King," a queen. We'll sing, "God save our gracious King." Because the queen will be dead, and we will no longer praise her. We will now praise the king. But that will never happen to this king in Psalm 45. The songs that will be sung will always be about him, not his children. His name will be remembered and praised forever and ever. Which makes us ask, just who is this royal wedding love song about? We've seen the beauty of his words, the beauty of his war, the beauty of his rule, the beauty of his bride, the beauty of his children. But who is he? Well, in the first instance, it certainly looks like it's a king in history. We have the gold of Ophir in verse 9, the people of Tyre in verse 12, which gives it an historical setting. Some people think this is a love song about Ahab and his marriage to Jezebel, who was from Sidon, a foreign country. But that wasn't really a marriage that any Israelite could sing about. I think Solomon's marriage to Pharaoh's daughter might be the best guess. We know Solomon was handsome from the Song of Songs, and his father David was handsome. He had the good look genes in him. Solomon was known for his wise words, words of grace, we might say. We know he married a foreigner, Pharaoh's daughter, who had to leave her father and people and come. She was like a latter-day Ruth who committed to the faith of Israel. Tyre was the most prosperous neighbor to Israel in Solomon's day. So there are good reasons to think it's about Solomon. But that can only be a guess. Because the songwriter has written this song in such a way that he's left us guessing. If it was about Solomon, why didn't he just say it's about Solomon? Besides, look at some of the descriptions. They're larger than life. They're too good to be true. He's too beautiful to be real. He's a man beyond our wildest dreams. He's in another league to Solomon. Just glance back over the psalm. Let me point out a few things. Verse 2, "you are more handsome than the sons of men." Literally is, "you are more handsome than the sons of Adam." It's as if this king is in another league to all the descendants of Adam. In verse 2, he is said to be blessed eternally. Solomon was only ever blessed initially by God. His kingdom starts off well, but then when he commits idolatry through his many marriages to foreign women, the kingdom splits. God removes his blessing. In verse 3, this king is presented as a warrior, and the only other great warrior in the Old Testament is God, who rides forth in splendor and majesty. In verse 6, this king is addressed as God. Now, I said earlier that that's not exactly out of place, but kings in the Old Testament were more God-like, divine-like, God's representatives. But here, this king isn't God's representative. He is God. Verse 7, he's anointed the happiest king on earth. Verse 9, he is the envy and praise of the daughters of many kings. Verse 16, he's promised princes who will rule over the earth, not just over Israel. Verse 17, he's promised eternal praise from the nations. Here is a king who is peerless, who is beyond compare. Here is the king of all kings. Here is Jesus Christ, the most beautiful of men, because he is more beautiful than all the sons of Adam. There's the beauty of his words. They drip with grace. They forgive. They free. They favor undeserved sinners like you and me. And isn't that the defining mark of our Lord Jesus? Because Isaiah tells us that there was no outward beauty that we should behold him. Have you ever thought that Jesus probably had something like a big nose, sticky-eyed ears, maybe a monobrow, maybe a square face, that if you saw him in a crowd, you wouldn't take a second look at him because he wasn't that good-looking? And yet, he was the most beautiful of men. Why? Because his lips dripped with grace. You just had to hear him speak and you were captivated. There's the beauty of his war. He fights for good and just causes in the name of truth, humility and righteousness. Just think of how he went to war with the devil in the wilderness. He spoke the truth. Think of how he went to war with the Pharisees. He condemned their wickedness. Think of how he went to war with the world authorities in Jerusalem. He exposed their pride by riding into Jerusalem on a donkey. And he humbled himself still further by becoming obedient even to death on a cross. That's the kind of wars this king fights. There's the beauty of his rule. He established through his death and resurrection a kingdom of uprightness. And seated at the Father's right hand, he still loves righteousness. And he still hates wickedness. There's the beauty of his bride. That's you and me this morning. But remember, our beauty only comes from him. That's why we're not the center of attention at this royal wedding. How could we be? The king had to die so that we might be presented in splendor, without spot or wrinkle or any such thing. As Robert Murray McShane puts it beautifully, when I stand before the throne dressed in beauty, not my own. And finally, there's the beauty of his children. That's us as well. That's you, boys and girls. If you choose to follow King Jesus, you can be his princes and princesses that rule the earth and cause the nations to eternally praise his name. You, boys and girls, are the king's reward. So that's who this song is really about. It's about King Jesus. If we think it's just about Solomon, then we're short-sighted. If we think it's about Solomon and Jesus equally, then we're cross-eyed. It is about Solomon in the first instance, but only as a shadow of the one greater than Solomon who was to come, the King of all kings. And why has God put this psalm in the Bible? Because he wants us to fix our eyes on the King. Whatever your circumstances are at the moment, God the Holy Spirit says to you this morning, don't take your eyes off your King. Whatever your struggles are in your singleness, in your marriage, with your children, without children, wanting more children, with your job, in your old age, with your aches and pains, whatever your circumstances are, God says to you this morning, fix your eyes on the King. Because soon and very soon, we are going to see the King.